everyone. Welcome to a new episode of One Vision, the FinTech Views. This is Theo, your host for the episode, along with Stephanie Foster, my wonderful partner in crime and the other host of the podcast. Joining us today is Michelle Bayo, founder of Finnovator. Welcome to the show, Michelle.
Thank you, Theodora, Stephanie. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Yay! I know that we had a lot of backstories before we started recording, but if we just were to cut to the chase, tell us a little bit more about the company that you started. What is the inspiration behind it? Because I think you and I shared a little bit of a common industry before we ended up where we are right now.
Yeah, I'll give a little backstory. I started Finnovator almost 5 years ago. My 5-year anniversary will be this July. I started the organization largely because I realized that everything I had done in my career in the corporate world kind of led to the aspects of the future of finance. So I did 20 years in corporate, 6 years in telco, 8 years in online shopping affiliate marketing, 3 years in prepaid and payments innovation, 1 year in blockchain and digital identity with consent on blockchain. And then I won Money 2020 Rise Up, where they pick 30 women from around the world, bring them into Money 2020 with this accelerator. And when I got the news, I largely realized, A, I didn't want to give the PR to the startup that I was working at. And B, when I thought about it, everything I had touched actually touches the future of finance. So I got this strong desire to jump out and create my own company. So in 24 hours, I built a brand, downloaded a logo, created a website, incorporated, and became the CEO of Finnovator, largely so that I could help multiple companies and soon to be individuals take one step towards a future of finance.
I would probably brand your story as someone who takes control of their own future in this open future world of whatever it is that you want to grasp. That's one of the things we often talk about in the industry is about your personal story. You are the one who makes it interesting. You are the one who takes the opportunity and run with it. So kudos and very, very just amazing. I love talking to people who start their own company, especially with a story like what you just told us. Now, tell us a little bit more about open data. Because recently you talked about that being a journey towards empowerment of consumers and SMEs. On this show, we love to talk about what we can do for consumers and what we can do for small businesses. Can you elaborate a little bit more what you mean by that? And perhaps let's start with the very, very basic, because I still get questions. What is open banking? What is open finance? And what is open data?
Yeah, it's one of my favorite topics. So open banking is allowing consumers to be empowered to use their data to help them get better services, better offerings, more affordable offerings, more custom offerings. And really how it works is, well, here's a little backstory. Open banking started in the UK. It started in 2018. It started largely because both in the US and in the UK, there was a financial crisis in 2008, largely because there's some bad actors in the industry. And what happened is there was a loss of trust a lot with consumers and bank behavior in those markets, not with all of the banks, but kind of this sentiment that there was this challenge of who do I trust? And what happened coming out of the UK is the government decided that they were going to force the CMA9, so the 9 major banks in the UK, to pay for an open banking system. And this system would allow the data that is held at a bank on a customer to be shared, but in a safe and compliant way through an API, a backend technology with one endpoint and access to another endpoint through consumer consent only. So by doing this ecosystem change to have what they call open banking or permission data sharing based on consumer control, consumer consent, allowed for this kind of new environment where, okay, now the banks have to share the data. Now fintechs or third-party providers, TTPs as they're called, were able to get accredited, which meant that they had to hit a higher bar of cybersecurity, of compliance, to be able to be allowed in this open banking ecosystem. And there's over 300 that got approved and are within the ecosystem. And this allowed these fintechs that if their consumer so asked, that they would be able to share their data. So if you were leaving one big bank for one part of your business and wanted to go to a fintech to, let's say, use a challenger bank like Revolut, so that when you travel, there's less FX fees, there's less fees to have this bank account, and it kind of transcends borders in the sense that there's Revolut all over Europe. So if you wanted to get a Revolut account, you could sign up without giving your password to your bank, which most people don't know, they kind of do when they use something called screen scraping, and you're going to log in and it looks really easy and it's just like log into your bank and then it pops up. What that's doing in screen scraping is giving continuous access to your back end bank account to give constant data of all of the transactions to give you a summary. This is something that should be illegal long term. In the UK, this whole ecosystem was spun up because 1 million UK citizens started screen scraping. They got really nervous that was a really high security risk. So they created this permission-based back-end consent. I am a customer at a bank in the UK. I'd like to work with Revolut. I'd like to give permission for Revolut to get all of my banking data to give me the right product that makes sense for me and advise me on different products that might make sense to save me money. So that's the first blush of an open banking ecosystem. What happened past that is this has spurred up a whole new infrastructures, new fintechs, VC dollars, consumer empowerment, but just for the banking sector. So when you look to Australia, they came at this model and they started thinking, you know, they had two major data breaches that actually compromised half of the country's population. It was a huge concern. So everyone was concerned about their data. So they didn't come into it because there was bad banking behavior. They came into it because there's these massive data breaches. So they're like, they're looking at the UK and so impressively, they thought bigger. They didn't think we just want to enable better competition. They were thinking like, I need to protect my consumers across all industry. So they created something called a CDR. And a CDR is a consumer data right that transcends multiple different industries. So they came out with a rollout plan that in 2020, they would launch open banking, which they did in the midst of a pandemic. So hats off to them. That was pretty impressive. Then they went to open finance, open telco, going to open energy, and then open data. So they were thinking, if we give a consumer data right to port their data versus on consent, then this can create an entire open ecosystem where the consumer's in control of their data. It goes through a secure backend pipe with only secured accredited bodies to have access to this data, and it creates this empowerment. So now the UK is now moving to open finance. And what that does is think about this as like a small business owner. If I'm able with my accounting system to, instead of giving 15 passwords of screen scraping to get my accounting system to see what's happening in my business, if I can have safe and secure ways to share what's happening across all my different partnerships, like my telco bill, my energy bill, all of my financial bills, when we get to open data, then that's going to save me time. That's going to secure my business better. And then with all of these new insights, I can have a dashboard that shows me where I'm spending too much. It can give me new ideas of who I should potentially be utilizing. And that's what you're starting to see in the UK. They have these dashboards where they say, well, if you use this credit card instead of the current credit card or any one of these three options, here are the three benefits. And then you could click on the button and you can actually apply in a safe and secure way. And you could close your other account. So there is a fast, efficient way to not just tell people they could do better or tell people they could save more, but actually give them the tools, the infrastructure, and the safety to allow them to do this, not just in their banking, not just beyond banking and insurance and wealth and mortgages, but my goal is to get to open data, where I could also do this when I talk about energy saving options with different organizations or potentially moving my social platform and moving the data from a social platform to another social platform because I no longer align to the values of the one that I might be on.
So it encourages mobility, encourages a true 360 view of a consumer, every aspect of us, of who we are, what we use, what we are beyond just money. I mean, isn't that like what we've often talked about? I don't even remember how many years we've been talking about 360 degree view of a consumer, but it was never a true 360 because there are so many aspects of our lives that we had not touched, that through what you just explained, we could have create a better, more holistic solution for what we do. So Steph, do you think we might see that here in, I don't know, 2050, perhaps? That's a cynical question.
I mean, I would think that's, it's, we're several years away from that, because the biggest question out of all of this is always who owns the data, right?
We don't. At least not right now. I think all the platforms and the various entities out there own different bits and parts of us, except us.
Pretty much.
I truly see it as this should be a human data right enabled around the world, country by country. We are the ones creating the data. The data is about us. The data should be owned by us. I don't know if it needs to be held by us, because I don't think you could trust consumers to have the right cybersecurity infrastructure to hold your identity record in that sense. But these are trusted parties that you are giving permission from one trusted party to share with another trusted party. And for the first time ever, have a delete button saying you shall no longer hold this data about me, because I still want to work with you, but you got the data on me to decipher what product I needed and to get to know me better, because we were new partners in this relationship of this product. But now you have 3 months of data on me, and I feel like we're creating a product together, right? That more suits me. Delete my past data.
Which reminds me, there is a new product called Permission Slip that got rolled out recently in the United States, and it's app by Consumer Reports, so it's free. I have started using it a month ago because I'm so tired of getting telemarketing, unwanted calls, emails bombarded by stuff. So they actually have a list of merchants listed within the app that you can request the app to act on your behalf, to request those merchants to delete your data and not sell your data. So far I've been doing it. I've been pinging, I think I submitted at least maybe 30, 40 requests already. And I've started hearing back from some of the companies, this is a confirmation, this is what you want to do. And yes, we have deleted your record. I would love to see more of that. Not everyone will have the time to do it, but I would like the option to, as a consumer, like you say, this is my data. I should have a say-so in what you're doing with my stuff.
Yeah, I would just layer onto that the fact that, you know, you'll see some in your inbox for your emails. Sometimes there's a service for unsubscribe, and it tells you who you're subscribed to. So you could mass unsubscribe to all of these things you just subscribed for as you were purchasing something. They gave you 10% off for the first time for your kids. And now you're hearing all about, you know, I don't even know, this makeup that my daughter wanted, and now they think I'm her, right? So I'm getting all these things that I would not be into. But I think it's also just thinking the cybersecurity. When we were traveling in Barbados and we were at FinTech Island, it was the biggest data breach in the world to date. And knowing that, you know, ByteDance got breached and many others, even things like my MyFitnessPal, things that you sign up for and you might put a very weak password on, or that password might be utilized in multiple places because you're like, I don't really use Evite that often. It was just for a couple kids' birthdays. I still have the account. But now all of these accounts got breached. And if people don't know they got breached, A, they're not going to go change their passwords. B, these are all the places that still have your data. Right. So I think that's amazing. The company you mentioned, please share it, because I'm one of those people who will literally go in and spend 2 hours and delete and ask to delete, because no one should have a record of you that you're no longer working with as well. And I think that's a really big challenge for a lot of North Americans. We sign up to everything for loyalty points, for slight discounts, for newsletters, but then we forget about it. And now we have 177 passwords. But we only use maybe 30 or 40 of these infrastructures.
I think they're actually banking on you forgetting about it. That's the scary part. Speaking of, I was recently in Europe and traveling in Spain. One of the car riding app asked me to upload a copy of my passport to verify my identity. I'm like, yeah, no, I don't trust you. I don't know if I like you, and absolutely not. So I ended up calling a cab from the street. Like under no circumstances will I be randomly uploading a copy of my passport for you. So these are nuances. I think along with the ability for consumers to take action, we also need education, right? We need to educate consumers, even all of us, on what our rights are and what we really should do and shouldn't do, the digital hygiene, which I hope that the next generation are going to be a little bit better than us. Let's look forward a little bit. So Michelle, I want to pick your brain before we switch gear. What are some of the things that you think we would see with regards to the use of consumer financial data this year? Give us some tips in your magic globe on what do you see in the future?
Yeah, I think there's so many places that are already living in the future. Like I think in North America, we all realize we're most likely 10 years behind in some of the technology that we're seeing of what's coming out of Asia, what's happening in Brazil, what's happening in Australia. I think if we truly look at some of these opportunities, you look to Brazil, right? And they do have some different challenges than in North America, but because they enabled open banking in one of the fastest implementations in the world, Brazil decided they were moving to open banking, launched it in 12 months across the entire ecosystem with legislation, and then gave direct access for the fintechs to the central bank. And you know what that did? It reduced cost for sending money, accessing money, and having a bank account to a degree that I don't have the exact percentage, but people were going from paying $50 to send money for it to be then $5. Like there was a mass savings to a very underbanked, cash-driven society, or still had a strong hold on some of the aspects of the ecosystem. And then a company called Pix was created. And this Pix organization is doing billions of dollars in transactions. They've taken the underbanked, the unbanked, the people keeping cash in their under their mattress, and brought them back into the digital society. They've actually transitioned something like 200,000 merchants now have a Pix terminal when they used to be just cash. And that's because these Pix terminals can be on phones, can be on iPads. The fee to take bank-to-bank transfers is obviously very, very low, but it's just basically brought in a whole new ecosystem and given this digital record to Brazilians and allowed them to be part of the digital society. Therefore, they're building credit. Therefore, there's less cash. I'm hoping there's less crime because there's less cash held on people, held in stores. It's a revolutionary movement. And in the US, there's still a lot of unbanked by choice, not by choice, or just underserved. And I think as you start to see things become permission-based, as we move to, Dodd-Frank 1033, and the US starts moving towards open banking and permission data sharing in the financial ecosystem, it's going to start spurring up a lot more of this holistic banking I was talking about. I think what I'm realizing, and I don't know if this term exists or if I just made it up, but I think in North America, we're like micro bankers at this point. Maybe it's a millennial and below thing, but we have our core bank. And we use them for many things, and we maybe use them for many more things in the past, but we still definitely use them and trust them. But we're also open to start, I'm going to use Robinhood to do a little micro investing. So, they've kind of moved a little bit of their investing externally. I'm going to use this insurtech company because I feel like it's faster and easier to get travel insurance or life insurance. I'm going to use this other micro bank for part of my business banking. So now we're just microbanked all over the place, and it becomes even harder to see your holistic view because before you might have just, in our parents' day and age, all been with the same bank, have two bank statements or one, and there's your life. That's not the case. We're all complicated now. We all have personal opinions and want to have personalized products and feel more aligned to this brand versus that brand, and then we might move. So it's going to give us a better ability as this data sharing comes to play to have a dashboard, a personalized dashboard that's ours, that gives us a personal view so that we can be better at our financial future by actually being able to see it.
I really love how you just described that, Michelle, and now it's making me wonder as a society, like how far we've come to become so productized that we're all gravitating towards the best of breed for every part of our lives, right? Like you said, I want the best of breed solution for investment for me. I'm looking for the best of breed solution for investment for my kid, and so on and so forth. So I'm really curious to see where the future takes us. Is there a space in the future where we will end up with that holistic banking, or is that further than we even realize because we've become so focused on the best of whatever options are out there from a fintech perspective? So I love that you weren't there. All right. So I think we're shifting gear now to a little bit of a more fun, personalized piece of this conversation, Michelle. So there's one superpower that you have that you don't talk about a whole lot. And I don't know that, you know, many folks are aware that not only you're an athlete, but you were like a top fundraiser for Push for Tush 10K Run in Canada. And I'm really curious to hear a little bit more about your journey as an athlete and how has that really helped you to become the founder that you are today?
Yeah, great question. I was a soccer player, you know, as my son calls it, football. He's very into a World Cup. But yeah, I played soccer since I was 6. I was a ballerina, tap dancer, and also, you know, did jazz. Like I was very active as a kid. And I truly remember this. And maybe why I'm a little bit of a rebel, but I was a really good ballet dancer. I got an award when I was 6, and it was one of those old school ballet locations where they used to like slap your feet with like meter sticks because they wanted you to, you know, be specific on how you did that position. And I really truly remember that. It was very disciplined. And it wasn't just like you went to ballet class. There was like an exam at the end of every year. And if you didn't pass the exam, you couldn't go to the next level. So I was doing, I think, my ballet too. But at the same time, I loved soccer and I was a forward and I was always trying to score goals. And I might have done some like slide tackles as I was like trying to get the ball and I was going for the net. And I remember coming into my ballet exam and my knee was bleeding because that happens, right? Like you're playing soccer and you're running around the field and I guess whatever. So I'm doing my ballet exam and they failed me because my knee was bleeding and they're like, ballerinas don't, you know, your outfit is important. And I think you need to decide between ballet or soccer. Like this, ballerinas don't play soccer. And I said, okay, no problem. And I never went back to dance again in my life. So like, to me, I love soccer. I love the aspect of you're a team and you pass to each other and you accomplish something together. And there was something about that. And my parents are both entrepreneurs. And so this like parent lesson came in really early. They said to me, if you score or your team wins, there's ice cream. If neither of those things happen, great game. We're proud of you. But there's no reward. So I was like meant to be, I think, in sales very early on because there was like, you do, you get. And I do the same to my kids now. At the time, I was not a fan of this concept, but it definitely did push me to find the carrot. And the carrot was, how do we win? How do we push farther? How do I find the angle to get the goal? And, you know, I was the captain of the volleyball team and the basketball team. I just love sports. I loved group sports. Didn't really like individual sports, but I loved group sports. And I think it's helped me. I think when you realize early on in your life that you're able to work with others, and if you work well with others and you could figure out how to communicate with them, that you guys can win together. And this is kind of like a group achievement. And like, I really enjoyed the energy of that, that like we all got together and had this mission and practiced and then won and got ice cream. But I think it gave me that trajectory of like, if you do, you do, you get. And I think it's something that we need to constantly bring back to our kids because, yeah, we used to have trophies for one person and people would get upset, you know, that they didn't get there. But then the next year they would push and it would be someone else who got the trophy. But it created this you do, you get concept of, and I truly see that when I'm an entrepreneur, you know, going out on my own, I don't think I could have done it. I don't think if I wasn't an athlete in the sense of, you know, you have to work really hard, maybe that nobody's noticing, and then you bring it to the field and then you might score, but they might not have known the hours that you had spent practicing, falling, having bloody knees and just getting back up, or like you sprained your ankle and they're like, shake it off, get back out there. So it takes losing. It takes these hours of unwitnessed challenge to get to what you see on social media, to get to see the wins that you have as a business owner. And you get used to that, I think. And it's an up and down kind of ride. But I think if you have an experience that you think it's, you're just looking at it online, you think it's just all success, but you don't realize, you know, that athlete mentality of you do, you get. And talking about the triathlon, like this is a fun story. I worked for a company and we had done this really purposeful visa sponsorship where we were going to sponsor a whole bunch of athletes to go to the Olympics for triathlons. And by doing that, this partnership was basically going to take the youth that were doing triathlons for the first time, like at 6 years old, all the way up until when they were 18, and help give them tiny little motivations and sponsorships to help pay for their Nike shoes or help pay for their flight or help pay for their registration for a race. So we were gifting them this big, huge virtual check at this event, and I was running marketing and sales and the biz dev team. And so they're like, we're just, I'm like, let's bring everybody. Let's bring the whole companies, families, their kids. Let's give them all free signups to this triathlon. And that's where we'll give the check. So everyone's kids all signed up. It was super cute. They did like one length of the Olympic size swimming pool with like floaties on. And then they came out and had like the little tricycle and did like 100 meters and then ran 100 meters. And then they all got like a medal for finishing the race and like bubble gum and I don't know, bubbles. So this was so fun. I was like, this is exciting. So my son did it. And then my daughter was the oldest of everybody's kids in this entire event, like of all of the company that I worked for. So she was 8. So she gets at the front of the pool, saw everybody all day. She's like ready to do this one length, 100 meter, 100 meter. Everyone has swim caps on and goggles. And I didn't bring either of these things for her. She had to do like 4 laps of the Olympic size swimming pool, get out, get on her bike, do a like kilometer bike ride, and then get out and do a kilometer run. She had no idea what she was getting into. She just got to the front of the pool, jumped in, and when she finished, they had to like run back and get her, and she was the last to finish for the day, and she was crying, and she's like, I'm last. I'm like, you finished. You didn't know what you were gonna do. You didn't, you literally just went and you finished. And let's be honest, a triathlon is you against you. It's not about anybody else. You come back next year, we'll get you the goggles, we'll put like the cap on, we'll practice. It's you against you. She goes, Mommy, I'll come back if you come back. So I'm like, okay. So I signed up for a sprint triathlon to prove to my daughter that it's you against you. And I didn't die. I didn't fall and I did finish. So that was it only like I'm not a triathlete. This is not some magical thing I want to go do again. I'm just proud that because I love my daughter so much, I did 8 laps of the Olympic sized swimming pool and did a 5K or a 10K bike and a 5K run. And then I laid down on the finish line like I had, I don't know, accomplished the world and I slept for a week. It was great. I'm so happy I finished this thing. And I think it proves how much you can love your kids. And how, if you want to prove something to them, you will find this innate part of your body that you didn't think existed and pull it out of you. And I don't want to go too long, but the reason why I raised so much money for Push for the Tush, and this will get emotional. My best friend in the world who played soccer with me since I was 6, Shannon Fair, and lived like 10 houses down from me. She died of colon cancer in 2018. And when she died, she was my best friend, but she was also a human who just believed in love and really was an artist at heart. But because she felt like she wanted to make it in the world, she kept pushing, like she wanted to be a professor. She couldn't get in to be a professor. She kept trying. So she was a secretary. She never got to do what she loved until she found out she was sick and she fought cancer for 5 years and it wasn't in her family and it came out of nowhere. And instead of being a secretary for the last 5 years of her life, she was finally an artist. She finally published her work. She finally was, you know, making art all day, every day, till the day she passed. And emotionally, it was just her birthday. So I went to a tree we dedicated to her yesterday with a quote that she wrote in the art piece I bought, which sits on my desk. And it's largely the reason I think I started the company and took the risk to just go do what I want in the world. Her comment is, there's a silent security in knowing that you're part of something bigger. And I hope everyone in the world kind of realizes that they're part of something bigger and then go does something bigger. Because sitting down and just thinking the world is against you instead of the world is here for you to pave your path. Like, we're all here to do something to make this world better, because we all know it needs more love in this current state than it ever has. And just go make the world better. Go do something that just, like, do something that makes you want to throw up, because I think it means you're in the right direction. Because honestly, getting on stage, largely that fear never goes away, but maybe both of you can kind of share the fact that getting off stage and knowing that you put your voice into the world that could maybe affect somebody else's perspective of how they can change the world, it's all worth feeling like you want to throw up.
Wow.
That's me, guys.
You are so inspiring, Michelle. I mean, so many stories and great nuggets out of what you've just shared with us. You get. So true, right?
Where the hell did that go in the world? Right. Oh, I feel like it's lost. Like, why? I don't want to give my kids ribbons for participating. Participating is just part of the journey. And then you were the best. Here's a trophy to look at to remember the time you were the best. You might not be the best in math. You might not be the best in science. Or you might be, and that might be your thing. Where did the trophy go for being the chess king or for being the MVP on a soccer field? That has went in your lowest points of your life that you could look back and say, in that point of my life, I was giving my all. Not trying to change the world, but it's slightly broken.
Hey, how do you change the world though? One person at a time. So it starts with each one of us, right?
That's literally what we use to describe the podcast when I first started the show, is okay. one voice, one vision of the future. We start off with one person, one soul at a time. You can't boil the ocean. But I remember my kids asked me a couple of years ago, why are you doing what you're doing? Because you literally work your day off if you're on your own. And I said, you know, because I want to go out and change the mind of just one person or three people. If I can do that and they can go out and change the hearts and minds of another one or three person, and they each go out and keep doing that, that's how we change the world. One person, one soul at a time.
I love that. You need to put that on a shirt or an art piece. I'll buy it. I'm all of, like, even the Mateo's like rebel.
He's the rebel. Be the rebel. Steph, you have something else you wanted to ask Michelle?
Yeah. So Michelle, I know that you did a TEDx interview around the rise of female founders, inclusion and diversity. And you talk about how 50-50 is driving profit. Tell us a little bit, like, how do you really substantiate that? And how do you believe that we as a society at large can really get behind the fact that 50-50 truly is driving profit?
Yeah, I can share. This was a new concept to me. I worked at a lot of organizations, as many do, throughout their career, where I was the only female. I was the only female in the room. I was the only female salesperson. And, you know, you think the world's that way. And then I got recruited to go work for this company, and my boss was Brazilian, and he had just come from Brazil, and he had this mission that he's like, I want to meet you. We met. He's like, I really like your vision. I'm like, I know nothing about payments. He goes, that's not my concern. He's like, I'm building a 50-50 female to male executive team. I believe in this. This was 2015. This was super early. And he had already had three men on the team and one female lawyer. And he's like, you can either be the head of retail and manage 100 retailers, or you can be the head of marketing and sales and run two divisions. And I'm like, well, I'm a marketer and a salesperson, so I'll leave the retail role for you. I'll take it. So I come in, and at the time it was just, you know, it was the three men who were running ops and general management, which was him and someone else who was running Six Sigma early on. Like this, he literally believed in process so much that he hired someone to teach us all about Six Sigma process mapping and process infrastructure. And then he hired this other female who I became such good friends with, and she already worked there. He just leveled her up, so she was going to run retail. And we were this 50-50 organization in an organization that had 30 countries. None of them were 50-50. We overachieved for 3 years as a Canadian infrastructure, which was a mature market, so they didn't see it coming. But it wasn't just 50-50, it was also process management and Six Sigma, but it was diverse thought at the top. And because it was diverse thought at the top, I diversified my team to be 50-50, because I saw the genius in it all. And then I got asked to go work at a different company, and I knew the CEO from my loyalty days. And he said, Michelle, I want you to come work at the organization, take any seat position you want. I don't know why I got so lucky in these two jobs to just tell me, what do I want to do? They just wanted to work with me. And I said, you know, I will only come if it's a 50-50 organization. And he's like, really? And I said, yeah, I will not be the only female voice in a room ever again. I know the genius of it. Trust me. So he went and hired the CMO, or sorry, a past CMO of Pepsi, and put her on as the CMO of this blockchain organization. And he got this woman who was from capital markets and put her on as like the chief client manager. And I was the C-level, they were C-levels. And we were pretty badass, I have to say, because we were 50-50 crypto kids to corporate, but we were also 50-50 male to female executive. And I don't mean putting women or men at the top just to get to 50-50. It takes time, it takes design, it takes maybe different women out of different fields, but it also takes asking them, because women won't apply for a role they don't think they are at yet. Women are very analytical, like to check at least 80 to 90% of boxes before they apply. But if you tap them on the shoulder and say, I have this role, I think you'd be a great fit, you should apply, they'll do it. And you can create a really incredible team. So I had done these two things. And then I got asked to join my first board seat. And it was at this organization on open banking. And it was one female board member and six male board members. And so it was one of my favorite female in the industry. So I was already like raring to go. But I said, you know, can I ask a favor? I really want to join, but I'd like it to be a 50-50 board, because I'm already on two 50-50 executive teams in my last two roles. And I just feel very passionate about it. And he's like, I've got two teenage daughters. Absolutely. So he let me, and in 6 months, I brought in three female CEO level industry experts from around the country to join the board. And I took over the board last year, changed the name of the company to OFNC, and we are still a very strong 50-50 board. When I did the TEDx, I did it with a lot of this knowledge, and then I did a lot of research. 17% more profits live in organizations that have 50-50. Even if it's just one male, one female, there's something about diverse thought. There's something incredible about having a problem and having both types of brains, both and different backgrounds look at this problem, and then be humble enough to know that every voice matters in this discussion. And then it doesn't just, if you have one male and all female, it's still hard for the male on the team, because then they become the sole voice. But at least if you have two or three, then they don't feel like, you see a lot of women that are on boards and they're the only female, and they're either very quiet or very loud, instead of just being able to just say whenever they feel they need to say, because they're either trying to be very seen to prove their value, or they're trying to be very quiet to just stay. But you give them another voice, they start to feel comfortable. You give them another voice, now we're just here. Now we're a team. Now we're a soccer player on a team, all trying with the same mission and the same goal. So I think it's psychological, but it's also, you build better products with different minds. And if you build a board that has a diverse thought of the right people, not for the check marks, you're not always going to be at 50-50. It's an intention. It is not a check mark. It is a goal to get the right people with the right backgrounds on a team. And then it will trickle through the whole organization.
I love that.
Pretty passionate.
I'm going to leave it at that. Discussion. We can tell this is coming through. This is something that, I don't want to speak for you, oh, Steph, but this is something that I believe all of us feel very, very passionate about, which is why we are here where we are. We need more of you. We need more people like you. We need more people like you who are willing to speak up, mm-hmm, and change the status quo, not just being there, but be an active participant. So thank you for that.
Yeah. Every board, honestly, that I try and join, advisory board, even if I'm helping a company and I feel like it's way off, I can't help but say it, because I only want to be aligned with people who believe in equality, who believe in this mission that every voice matters, No one's elitist. No one's better than anyone else. I don't understand that conceptuality, but I also don't think you should just hire a token X or a token Y. It's about finding the right fit, and you might not hit all the checkboxes. I don't think that's the goal. It's the intention, the mission that matters.
It is indeed the intention. Before we let you go, I do want to ask you something so we can leave that with the audience with. Knowing what you know right now in your journey as a fintech entrepreneur, as a speaker, someone who is passionate about pushing the envelope, creating a better world for all of us, what is the one thing that you would wish you had told your younger self, knowing what you know right now?
Yeah, I would say always be learning, lean into risk, lean into fear. That intuition that you feel that's like kind of burning, when that means you should put up your hand. That means you have something to say. When you're pushing through that uncomfortable place, that's where you grow. And read, even if it's podcasts or if it's, you know, music. There's something about listening to the lyrics or listening to someone else's thoughts on a podcast or reading like one of my favorite books, Angela Duckworth's Grit, because it goes back to the do you get infrastructure. Always be curious. Never think you've got it all sorted out, because we're all continuously growing and the world's going to throw things at you that you can't comprehend. And you're going to have to find an angle to stay positive, to stay strong, and to stay wanting to give your all to the world. So take care of yourself. Go to yoga. Go for walks. Hang out with friends. Listen to loud music. And then think of like what your genius is and figure out how to give it back to the world.
And hop on one of those scary life-changing rides if you could, because it does build character and change the world. So thank you so much for joining us today, Michelle. Would love to keep the conversation. Would love to hear back from you perhaps later this year, what's happening with your journey. I feel like we've learned a lot from just talking to you and spending time with you. So appreciate the time. And for the rest of our listeners, thank you so much for joining us for another episode of One Vision. We will talk to you all next week.